You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. There has been a flurry of political activity over the past few days. Set designers who have worked for the likes of Martha Stewart and Oprah are hard at work building a blockbuster set for the Republican convention. Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney have been on the offense on Medicare, and Joe Biden has come under some fire from both media organizations and politicians. But what has captured everybody's attention in the last few days is what Republican Representative Todd Akin of Missouri, who may be on track to win the seat of Senator Claire McCaskill and tip the balance of power in the Senate, when he talked about whether women who are raped should be able to have an abortion.
From what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something. You know, I think there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be in the rapist and not attacking the child.
So we're going to dive into the political implications of this in just a minute with our in-studio panel. But first, we are joined on the phone by Ziad Munson, a professor of sociology at Lehigh University, who is also the author of The Making of Pro-Life Activists. Ziad Munson, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kara.
So I know you've really looked at the pro-life movement, and I guess one of my questions is, there's a bunch of things that obviously Todd Akin talked about. When he talks about legitimate rape, is that a term that is used in the pro-life movement more broadly? It's not something I've heard before.
Well, the term legitimate rape itself is not necessarily used, but the idea that he was expressing, I think, is one that many activists within the movement also subscribe to. Akin's use of the term legitimate rape reflects a longstanding idea, not just in the movement, but in American culture, that women who speak up about rape are lying. And this is an idea that I think in many cases of rape, they believe the woman was somehow asking for it. And Mr. Akin's use of the term legitimate rape strongly implies that he believes many rape claims are not legitimate. And while that may not be a common view among the pro-life movement, one of the problems with being in the pro-life movement is that so many within the movement do not believe there should be any allowance for abortion services, even in the cases of rape. And this kind of myth just underscores that belief.
But the idea of legitimate rape, it sounds like you're saying, is there's sort of the rape that happens forcibly, and then there's the rape that maybe because of the way the woman is dressed or something, there's that belief that she somehow did something to invite this rape.
Exactly, and I think that that this idea that women ask for rape somehow by how they dress, by how they interact with men, and so forth, this is an unfortunate view in American culture generally. It also exists in the pro-life movement. I don't think that it's necessarily any more prevalent in the movement itself than among Americans more generally.
Okay, and then let's move to the other part of what Todd Akin said that's gotten a lot of attention, which is the sort of belief, which of course doctors have looked at and shrugged their shoulders, but this belief that if a woman is raped, somehow she won't get pregnant because her body knows how to respond, knows, oh, this is a rape, so I'm not going to get pregnant. Have you heard that in covering the pro-life movement? Is that the kind of rhetoric you have heard before?
Yes, I wouldn't characterize it as rhetoric. It's a myth, one of many myths that activists believe. One of the things, one of my main research findings in my work on the pro-life movement is that people tend to develop a particular position on the issue. In this case, they are opposed to abortion. And then they either find facts or they find myths that they come to believe in to support their basic worldview. And this particular kind of myth is one that I heard, this idea that that women's bodies won't get pregnant in cases of rape. But it's only one of several myths. I heard other myths among the movement as well, such as the idea that Planned Parenthood distributes birth control pills that are deliberately that deliberately don't have enough birth control in them so that women will get pregnant and therefore need to get abortions from Planned Parenthood. There are myths like these that activists in the movement believe, and those beliefs help them in supporting their basic notion that abortion is never acceptable.
And finally, it sounds from what you're saying like this is not going to hurt him in the pro-life community. But I wonder, do you see this as being a problem for either Todd Akin or even maybe more broadly for presidential contender Mitt Romney?
Well, I think what's unusual about the beliefs that Mr. Akin expressed is not that he believes them. They're not uncommon, as I said, within the movement. But what is uncommon is for a politician to make those comments, because obviously they are out of step with what the majority of Americans believe about abortion. And so that's somewhat unusual. It definitely is a black eye for the Romney campaign. I think that they will have some guilt by association. But at the same time, most research shows that despite all of the heat that is generated around the abortion issue, abortion itself seldom is the definitive issue when it comes to determining elections. So I suspect in the long term in this presidential campaign, it is not going to affect the ultimate outcome.
Ziad Munson, professor of sociology at Lehigh University, also the author of The Making of Pro-Life Activists. Thanks for joining us, and we'll let you catch your plane now.
Very good. Thanks so much, Kara. Bye-bye.
And I'm also joined in the studio by Jeffrey Berry, professor of political science at Tufts University, and Peter Ubotasio, the chair of the Department of Political Science and International Studies at Stonehill College. And Jeffrey Berry, let me turn to you first on this. What did you make of the Todd Akin comment, and how far do you think the resonance of this comment has to go?
It's going to resonate quite far. Let's set the stage here, and then Peter can jump in. There was a primary in Missouri last week. There were three Republicans running, all of them conservative, all of them trying to demonstrate that they were the most conservative, most Tea Party-friendly candidate. The Democrats actually intervened and started to advertise in ways that were going to benefit Akin because they knew he had a propensity for gaffes. This isn't the only ridiculous thing that he said. He's come out against school lunches, for example. He's called student loans, college student loans, a cancer. So in an upset, Akin wins, and lo and behold, he shows that the Democrats were actually wise to try to get him to win the nomination. This is a conservative state. Akin may win anyway. But he's made himself a subject of ridicule. And so while Professor Munson's right, abortion's not going to settle this race in Missouri or nationally, the fact that he doesn't appear to be a capable, intelligent person could sink him. So he's put this seat back in play. It was really a seat that everybody expected the Republicans to win.
Right. I mean, certainly up until at least a couple of days ago, he was up by 5-6 points against Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. Right. She's very endangered. And I guess one of the things that I wonder when I hear about this is, okay, were the 50% of people, if it's about 50-45 in favor of Akin against McCaskill, were the 50% of people who are currently supporting Todd Akin in Missouri, do they hear this and Peter Ubotasio think, I'm shocked, there's no way I could support this guy?
Well, I think a percentage of them do. Certainly there are hardcore supporters. Jeff's pointed out this is a conservative state. He was likely to do well in any case. But I think there are a number of his supporters now who will look at this comment and will read it and reread it and really question his judgment. And I think it's astonishing that he was able to conform to Democratic expectations within 1 week. In less than a week, he's committed a gaffe. And I think it's a pretty significant gaffe. And he's tried to back out of it by saying he misspoke, and that clearly doesn't work.
Yeah, and let me read that statement that he issued. Here it is. In reviewing my off-the-cuff remarks, it's clear that I misspoke in this interview, and it does not reflect the deep empathy I hold for the thousands of women who are raped and abused every year. I recognize that abortion, and particularly in the case of rape, is a very emotionally charged issue, but I believe deeply in the protection of all life, and I do not believe that harming another innocent victim is the right course of action. To dialing this back work, do you think, this statement?
Well, it remains to be seen. I don't think it will work because his initial statement was just so incredibly off-kilter and out of touch with what most Americans think about abortion politics and about rape. I don't think it's an example of misspeaking, to be honest. He didn't mispronounce a word, for example, or misstate a fact, though he did conjure up some myths. I think that this is likely to stay with him for a while. We have fellow Republicans calling on him to denounce his own words more fervently than he has, and some now calling for him to step aside. So I think this is going to last for a bit.
Yes. Yeah, speaking of fellow Republicans, Scott Brown just this morning has called on Todd Akin to step aside. And here is Scott Brown's comment. And the interesting thing is here, the degree to which Scott Brown worries probably that this will reverberate in his own race in Massachusetts. So here's what Scott Brown says. As a husband and father of two young women, I found Todd Akin's comments about women and rape outrageous, inappropriate, and wrong. There is no place in our public discourse for this type of offensive thinking. Not only should he apologize, but I believe Representative Akin's statement was so far out of bounds that he should resign the nomination for U.S. Senate in Missouri. And Jeff Berry, I'm going to play a little clip for you. This morning for Morning Joe, you're going to hear Joe Scarborough and John Heilman discussing Representative Akin's comments and how they affect races all across the U.S.
But the thing is, this hurts everybody.
That's right.
This hurts everybody.
It's bad for every candidate.
I agree with that.
This hurts George Allen in Virginia. This hurts Scott Brown in Massachusetts. This hurts every candidate.
And because, as we've seen, the Obama campaign is very good at dominating news coverage with issues that it wants to drive.
Right.
This is not an issue that Mitt Romney is going to be able to ignore one way or the other. He could try to ignore it, but the Obama campaign is going to keep it in his face for every day that goes forward.
Jeff Berry, is it possible that the ripples of Todd Akin in Missouri reach out to Scott Brown in Massachusetts?
I think that's a far stretch. But I think what the Scott Brown comment this morning is interesting, because if I was the Democrats, I'd play that back in Missouri. So I think the super PACs are going to come in and they're going to pound away at Akin and continue to put this this story up front. This is a story with legs. I don't think it's going to affect Romney because there's too many other national issues that people are really focused on. And I don't think that people believe that the Republican Party in general is has a stand on a legitimate rape that's similar to Representative Akin's.
It's interesting. I talked to Theda Scotchpole from Harvard not that long ago. She was sitting right here and she's written a book on the Tea Party, and I asked her, you know, do you think the Tea Party will impact Romney? And apart from the Tea Party actually supporting Romney, she said that she thinks there is a possibility that the Tea Party has pulled the Republican Party so far in one direction that it inadvertently hurts people who are trying to run either nationally or somewhere in the middle, the way that Scott Brown is much more of a centrist candidate, obviously, than Todd Akin, but that there's sort of these unintended consequences of people perceiving the Republican Party as more extreme than maybe they once did.
Well, the Republican Party certainly has been pulled to the right by the Tea Party, but let's make sure that we understand that the Tea Party is much of the Republican Party. Most Republicans approve of the Tea Party. There's really not much of a distinction. They're simply the most conservative members of the Republican Party. They're not some distinct organization that are made up of independents.
Okay, let's talk a little bit, Pre-Ritter Ubertasio, about the issue of Medicare, which has been all over the map. We've heard this number of $716 billion bandied around by both sides. And we saw Paul Ryan going down to Florida. His mother spends part of the year in Florida. He took his mother with him to the Villages, a place called the Villages in Florida, which is very heavily Republican. And here he is talking about how important Medicare is in our system.
Say hi to my mom, Betty. Medicare was there for our family, for my grandma, when we needed it then. And Medicare is there for my mom while she needs it now. And we have to keep that guarantee.
Peter Ubertasio, what do you make of this mud fight on Medicare? Who knew that we would be here with Paul Ryan as the VP?
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, I think that's a great visual, you sort of being able to introduce your elderly mother in Florida and say, you know, she is a beneficiary of this. My family is. I care about it. It really does help to, I think, blunt some of the attacks that he's undergoing. When Mitt Romney decided to choose Paul Ryan, they had to have a plan for responding to the inevitable attacks against his budget, which seeks to alter Medicare. And so I think that it is a natural consequence of the choice, even though I think fundamentally the election will be decided on the state of the national economy. Medicare has sprung up as an issue simply because of Romney's choice.
Do you think people have any sense now with sort of all the back and forth arguments and ads who would be doing what with Medicare in the future?
Well, I don't actually. I think that ultimately the decision to choose Ryan may ratify someone's desire to vote for Mitt Romney or not. You know, for that ever shrinking pool of independent voters who are looking for a reason that maybe they liked Mitt Romney to begin with and looking for another reason to like him, maybe Paul Ryan helps to solidify their choice. But for that other group that they were unsure, they didn't like Romney to begin with, they think he shifts positions or that he can't be trusted with the presidency again, the choice of Ryan may help move them away. But I think vice presidential candidates tend to not figure in that greatly, ultimately, on election day.
Jeff Berry, we certainly have seen seniors be pretty reliable for Republicans recently. They come out on the Republican side. And I wonder, do you think all this discussion about Medicare and should it become a voucher program in the future, which is built in a little bit to the Ryan plan, do you think that has switched the landscape at all for seniors, people in Florida, people in Nevada, you know, a lot of places where there's retirees?
It's not a great issue for Republicans. 6 out of 10 Americans approve of the Medicare program the way it is. And so only a minority are in favor of switching to a voucher program. So in that sense, the Democrats have this issue on their side. And it's not clear to me what advantage Republicans have in making Medicare an issue front and center. However, I think the reason for the Ryan selection was that at the time he was selected, the election seemed to be slipping away from Romney. There's a lot of polls that came out that showed a very large lead for Obama nationally, and Romney was trailing in virtually all the swing states. And so I think the Romney campaign, while it may have been leaning in Ryan's direction anyway, felt they needed a game change. They needed to electrify their base and get people excited and get people focused on what Romney offers. And I think in that sense, they accomplished it. But, you know, there's this negative that goes with that.
Well, has it done it? Has it given them the boost that they needed?
I think there's been a very slight bump for Romney. I think he's gone up a tiny bit in the polls. So in that sense, yes, I think that will dissipate. I think overall, if Ryan has any impact at all, and I agree with Peter, vice presidential candidates rarely have any impact. If it has any impact at all, I think there'll be a slight advantage to the Democrats among some wavering seniors.
I mean, Peter Ubertasio, you know, before Ryan was picked, there was discussion about Marco Rubio dealing with the demographic group, or about bringing on board somebody from Ohio. You know, the idea of can you help? I mean, Lyndon Johnson did this, obviously, for JFK. Like, can you bring on a constituency with that VP pick? And I think certainly Nate Silver has written about this in the New York Times, that the Ryan pick surprised everybody because Wisconsin is, I guess, close to being a swing state, but it might be hard to swing the Republican way. So the question is, what did you think of the Ryan pick, and has it done in the last week or so what the Republicans might have hoped that it would do?
I think it's done what Mitt Romney hoped that it would do, and I think that we overstate the case on the question of geography. I mean, can a vice presidential candidate bring their state with them? Lyndon Johnson did in 1960, but Lloyd Benson couldn't do that for Michael Dukakis in 1988, and Al Gore wasn't chosen for his geography, I mean, or at least for his ability to bring that electoral state with him. So I think that we often overstate the case. If Mitt Romney was looking to choose someone who could fire up Republicans and really help unify his party, bring a fresh face to the scene, and he wanted to choose someone, I think, with whom he felt personally compatible, someone he could imagine himself governing with, that really does limit the pool of prospective contenders. And so, you know, I don't think that the choice of Rubio was going to reshape this race. I don't think Latino voters were going to look at that pick and say, well, you know, I'm going to give the Republicans a shot here. I mean, if the Republican Party decides to finally line up behind significant and serious immigration reform and stop demagoguing on that particular issue, then they have a chance for Latino voters. But choosing Marco Rubio, I don't think, was going to make any bit of difference in that demographic group.
We have seen in the last few days some really virulent rhetoric directed against Paul Ryan. And I know you both said the VP pick doesn't matter. This is from Maureen Dowd. But beyond the even-keeled Ryan mien lurks a full-tilt virulence. A moderate demeanor is not a sign of a moderate view of the world. You know, Jeff Barry, is there any sense that this kind of lack of moderation, we've certainly heard a lot of discussion of the philosopher Ayn Rand, who Paul Ryan has said at different times that he followed. Is this going to have any kind of impact, do you think, on the race?
No. I think this race is about Romney and Obama, and who people are confident about leading them into the next 4 years. And right now, there's a tiny advantage for Obama. I think Ryan elevated the Republican Party ticket in people's eyes a little bit and gave them reason to rethink. But I think in the end, it's really about those two candidates. And I don't think that the Ryan pick is going to have an impact.
Okay, let's go back to Romney then. The issue of taxes, interestingly enough, are still on the table, partially because Mitt Romney recently talked about paying his taxes at least a 13% rate going back the last 10 years. Let's listen to Mitt Romney talking about that.
I did go back and look at my taxes, and over the past 10 years, I never paid less than 13%. I think the most recent year is 13.6 or something like that. So I've paid taxes every single year.
Okay, and then we have a little clip yesterday from Meet the Press, Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley talking about why it's important, why the Democrats think that it's important that Romney still releases taxes. Let's listen to that.
We know that he has been engaged in tax avoidance schemes with offshore accounts, with in the Cayman Islands, in the Bahamas.
You're not suggesting anything unlawful. There's no evidence to say anything's all.
But it is tax avoidance. At a time when our country needs everyone's help to accelerate our nation's recovery, he's hiding his money in offshore accounts and betting against the future of the United States.
Peter Upertasio from Stonehill, is this a who cares thing? Who cares about Mitt Romney's taxes? Or is this something that resonates with people in middle America?
I think it can resonate. I mean, ultimately, I heard Mary Madeline say on one of the news programs that she believes the election will come down to Americans caring more about their taxes than Mitt Romney's. Republicans need to hope that that's true, that they're not going to care much about his tax rate. I think that the problem for Romney is that he's drawn this issue out over the course of years when there had been ample opportunity to put this information out there and perhaps try to put this issue to bed. He, for some reason, has refused to do that. And so here, announcing the percentage weeks after this became an issue just ensures another round of conversation on how much tax did this very wealthy man pay and where is he putting his money. I think it's probably not going to be that much of a significant issue if Americans truly believe going into November that the president is the wrong person to handle the challenges over the next few years and the economy is that bad that they can no longer trust the person in the White House.
If they're unhappy enough that they say,
"That's right,
whatever, we're just willing to take a chance with a new person."
I think that's right. I mean, I think if they really believe the country's on the wrong track, and they're not inspired by what they see in the president, that they're going to overlook this issue. We've elected extraordinarily wealthy men to the White House before. I don't think that Romney's wealth is going to be used against him. The question is really, you know, our tax system and the degree to which he understands a person's frustration and thinking he seems to pay a lot less in terms of the rate than ordinary Americans. Democrats are going to continue to try to use this against him. If they can link it to his economic program and raise a lot of doubt, then it can be a winning issue for them.
We're talking about the week in politics with Jeffrey Barry from Tufts and Peter Upertasio from Stonehill. Jeffrey Barry.
Yeah, I think this issue has damaged Romney a lot. What the polls show over and over again is that Americans really don't like Mitt Romney very much, unless you're a hyper, super conservative Republican. But the polls show that he's just not that likable. And I think the overriding issue is that Americans come to see him as someone who's detached from how the average American lives, who really doesn't relate to the struggle that every individual family has to put bread on the table every night. And I think this tax issue fed into that. And I think the tax avoidance issue that Governor O'Malley raised in on the clip that you just played is going to continue to resonate through the election. And I think come time for the debates, he's going to be asked about, why are you invested in the Cayman Islands? Why do you have a Swiss bank account? people can't relate to that. They don't understand why someone needs to put their money overseas. And so he was, as Peter was right, he was very slow to come up with just this small nugget of information about how much he paid.
And is throwing, I wonder if putting out those nuggets is like throwing a log on the fire. Like I just went to my filing cabinet and I checked my taxes and definitely have not paid under 13%. Yeah. And you can just see the media salivating. Like, can we go into
it's
that file cabinet? Where
bleed.
Would it be?
Right. Yeah. You know, you get it out of the way right away if you can.
Should he have done that? Should he have just months ago said, here's my 10 years or my 5 years or whatever of taxes, have fun, see
you
later.
It depends on what's in those taxes. I mean, if there are some really grotesque tax avoidance things in that past 10 years, he's probably right in saying, you know, that would actually even be worse than not releasing my tax return. So we really don't know that until we see it, but it has damaged him so far.
Hmm. And Peter Obotosiu, where does he go from here? Does he just hope and pray that people don't bring this up anymore, which is probably not going to work with the Obama folks?
Yeah.
But, I mean, what does he do? Does he put them out on the table? And Romney has actually thrown down the gauntlet and said there's no way every time we put anything out, people attack us. They seem to have thrown down the gauntlet, and then we'll get a nugget of information,
right,
and the whole thing blows up again.
Yes, I don't understand it. That strategy. They should have put out that nugget of information and then throw down the gauntlet and then have no more nuggets. But to have done that and then throwing this out seems to me rather odd and a strategic error. I think they only have one place to go, which is to avoid it, and they will resist any questions. You know, when reporters ask, as they will, Romney will avoid the question. He'll sit down in front of friendly media when he can. He'll have a stock answer for the debates. I doubt we're going to see any more nuggets of information on his taxes from that campaign. They really have no other place to go. If they're not going to release them, and they're not going to, he's going to have to continue to just reiterate that he's not going to do that. He's put all the information out there that he wants to, and that'll be that.
Speaking of trying to sort of create likability, I mentioned at the top that the Republican national campaign for in preparation for the convention has hired some fascinating people who have done set design for Martha Stewart, for Oprah Winfrey, in this real attempt to sort of make Mitt Romney more likable, to bring him into your living room in a really homey way. We've also, of course, heard that Donald Trump's going to be a speaker at the Republican convention. But Jeffrey Berry, when you look forward to this Republican convention, which has a set alone that's worth, I think, about $2.5 million, just the stage alone. What are you expecting?
What I expect is that Romney will give a very good acceptance speech, as will Paul Ryan. They're both good speakers. And I think you'll see a lot of rabid Republicans walking around on the floor and wearing funny hats, the same as you see at every convention. But the larger point is that conventions are antiquated. There's no suspense. And then on the broadcast networks, they're only an hour a night, typically. And when you have 250 cable stations on your TV, are you going to watch the conventions, Democrat or Republican? The likelihood is not, unless you're a junkie, like you and me and Peter.
Unless you're a professor at Stonehill College. So Peter Obotosiu, you'll be watching these conventions, right?
I will be watching from the floor, actually. I'm going to both conventions.
Oh.
So I'm very excited to see the set at the Republican convention and to see what all the fuss is about. You know, political conventions are forms of entertainment now, sometimes not very good entertainment, but visuals are important. And so when politics is driven by the media, it's driven by visuals in many instances. And so I think, you know, it's somewhat of an unfair criticism of them for spending money on visuals. The Democrats will spend money on visuals as well. They'll be moving their own candidate out of the convention hall for reasons that have nothing to do with what's happening at the convention, but for, you know, the narrative that they want to put together. So I think when you're putting all those people into that kind of hall, it's going to be broadcast all over the world, Mitt Romney's speech, Paul Ryan's speech, you do want to have the appropriate visuals. And who better to go to than Oprah Winfrey or Martha Stewart or others who have a high degree of expertise in that area?
Well, when you're there, you may feel like you're on Oprah's set. I want to talk here. We've been talking a lot about Romney. I want to switch a little bit to Obama. We saw a very, very interesting campaign ad pop up that looks at whether Obama has taken too much credit for killing Osama bin Laden. And I think we have got that one. Let's listen to it.
Mr. President, you did not kill Osama bin Laden. America did. The work that the American military has done killed Osama bin Laden. You did not.
So this is a group, Peter, called OPSEC, which calls Obama's leadership into question. It's a third-party group. And John Kerry has already responded and said, you know, this reminds me of something that happened to me. What did you make of this ad of, you know, against Obama?
Well, it reminds me of that sort of that animated movie. Is it Team America or Team USA?
Team America, World Police.
It's not going to have the same resonance, certainly, as the attacks against John Kerry, in part because President Obama presided over the taking out of Osama bin Laden. And I don't think he's actually been as he hasn't been wearing it on his sleeve as much as he's been criticized for doing. And credit is given where it's due. So I don't think this ad is going to have much of an impact, in part because the ads that go after, say, Kerry and foreign policy or his Vietnam service, rather, or that famous ad with Michael Dukakis in a tank, they worked because they fed into a narrative that pre-existed those ads. Let's say Democrats were weak on defense, for example. That doesn't work this year. Foreign policy is, by and large, a winning issue for the president. The trouble for the president is that this is not a foreign policy election, and concerns about foreign policy, even concerns about the wars, rank very low. And so I think this is an abysmal ad. I think the president deserves credit, and he's not been trumpeting it in the way that is being suggested here. But I also I don't think that these issues are going to resonate much.
Jeff Berry, this is a much longer piece of tape, and I do have to say that when you see a bunch of Navy SEALs forcefully saying that Obama has sort of taken credit for something that the Navy SEALs did, that is powerful.
I think that a lot of Americans have probably forgotten about Osama bin Laden and why you would want to run a commercial to remind voters that it was Obama who, under his leadership, that we got Osama bin Laden. Strikes me as a little odd if, you know, if the Republicans are actually paying for this or this this outside group. So I agree with Peter. I don't think this is going to resonate. I think most Americans think that Obama's done a pretty good job in terms of national security.
One final quick topic here. I'm going to play a clip, which I know you've all heard, Vice President Joe Biden talking in Danville, Virginia recently with this sort of famous quote about the banks and how they want to put people back in chains. Let's listen.
Romney wants to let he said in the first 100 days, he's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
We have seen some pretty strong response to this. On Meet the Press, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani talked about Biden and said that he's not doing a great job as vice president. Let's listen to that.
I was astounded by his remarks. When I first heard it, I didn't see the tape. I just heard it. And I was really startled by it. I thought, this is a really dumb remark. And that's why I said he's not so bright, and you wonder. And it isn't just that comment. I mean, Joe's a laugh line on Jay Leno. He's not a vice president. I mean, it's a joke. You never know what he's going to say.
Peter Ubertasio, this has escalated. He's not a vice president. He's a laugh line. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I think it was a dumb comment. It showed a certain amount of insensitivity. I'm always distrustful of politicians who are not native Southerners who try to fake a Southern accent. And then to suggest that the Romney-Ryan team wanted to put people in chains, I think leaves a lot to be desired. On the other hand, if Giuliani is right, and I don't think he is, Biden is laughing all the way back to the vice presidential mansion and to his office in the West Wing, whereas Giuliani could not make a run of it against either McCain or Romney. So I think Giuliani might himself choose to be a little bit more careful about the vice president.
And Jeff Berry, what was your take on Vice President Biden and the reaction that came out of New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani?
I think the Republicans are trying to distract Americans and try to get them to pay attention to Biden, who is gaffe-prone, and away from all the criticism of Paul Ryan.
Jeff Barry from Tufts University, thanks so much for joining us. And Peter Ubertasio from Stonehill College, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Callie Crossley is back in the studio. What's on tap, Callie?
Well, it's Monday afternoon, so that means we check in with our friends at Marketplace. Tess Viglin recently went on a ride-along with the LAPD and discovered that the impact of foreclosures on a neighborhood go well beyond the financial. She'll share that story in a minute.
That sounds really interesting. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.